Hi, this is Pep Phelan. I'm here with Dr. Brett Shannon. Hi, Brett.
Hi, Pep.
So tell me about yourself, your profession, where you're from, and, you know, what you're getting up to.
Thanks, Pep. Like you said, my name is Brett Shannon. I'm a medical doctor. So I'm based in Brisbane. My family are Noongar descendants. So that's one of the three tribes of the Quandamooka people from North Stradbroke and Moreton Islands. And I've lived in Brisbane all my life. At the moment, am an occupational environmental registrar with the College of Physicians here in Australia. I work in an injury clinic in Brisbane and sort of see my patients here in Brisbane in person and via telehealth all around the country. I'm also the chairperson of the Brisbane Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Community Health Service at the moment. So the Brisbane Aboriginal Medical Service is the second oldest Indigenous medical service in the country, behind Redfern. And we've had sort of significant increases in capacity over the last 10 years. And I've been working with that organization since I was a teenager.
Is that what got you interested in what you're doing?
Definitely. So I took a summer job when I was a teenager doing policy briefings for politicians under sort of the Aboriginal Health Council of Queensland, and then got a job from that with the Brisbane Aboriginal Medical Service doing similar things. And I think that definitely sparked my interest in sort of in health and working with the Aboriginal Medical Service. I worked closely with the doctors and sort of developed my understanding of sort of how the body works sort of in parallel with public health measures. And that was definitely the starting point of my career.
Yeah, so that's the next question I was actually going to ask you about your pathway into medicine, through medicine and actually into what you're doing right now. So what was your pathway from high school through to where you are now?
So I probably didn't take the quickest pathway, or my pathway was quite unique. I never thought I would do medicine. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I finished high school. So I did a double degree at university. So I did business and science and thought I'd just decide afterwards what I wanted to do. So I did those two degrees. Like I said, I worked with the Queensland Aboriginal Health Council and the Brisbane Aboriginal Medical Service and did a lot of public health work. And from that, got interested in epidemiology and then applied for the Masters in Applied Epidemiology program. This program ran out of Australian National University in Canberra. And it was a two-year program, a really hands-on program that you got to do a lot of field work. You got to work with outbreaks of disease, health surveillance programs, public health units, and really interesting work. So I really enjoyed that. And that cohort for that master's degree was only six people. So it's a very small niche cohort. And majority of the cohort were actually doctors. So I worked with doctors again very closely. And I think that encouragement from them to then apply for medicine. So in my final year of the master's program, I applied for medicine at UQ and got in and started medicine straight after that master's program. Mm-hmm. Medicine was a four-year graduate program at UQ at that time. The first 2 years is sort of your non-clinical years where you're based at the university, followed by 2 years of clinical rotations. Mm-hmm. So I finished sort of medicine and went in to do my clinical years at the hospitals in Brisbane. I did a lot of emergency medicine during this time. I did about 18 months of emergency medicine. I actually applied to do emergency medicine through the college, of the Australian College of Emergency Medicine. Started the training program, but had sort of interrupted the program to do some work and some visits, including the POACH leadership program where me and you met.
Yep.
So I interrupted my training, did some work in Alaska, bringing back some of the things they're doing with their Indigenous clinics to our clinics here in Brisbane. And then we did the POACH leadership program in London. And then I spoke at the PRIDOC conference in Hawaii and spent a week there learning what they're doing in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. Came back and I think I really just enjoyed the public health setting again and just wanted to change from purely clinical work. So I decided to finish up in emergency medicine. I got some work in occupational medicine. So not many people know about the College of Occupational Medicine. It's quite a new college, and it's not sort of one of the biggest colleges in Australia. So the College of Occupational and Environmental Medicine comes under the College of Physicians, and the work with occupational physicians mainly revolves around the occupational setting in terms of injuries at work, injured workers and ill workers returning to work, medico-legal work, health surveillance. So I work with clients in sort of the construction, aviation and mining industries about exposures. So exposures to sort of heavy metals, exposure to respiratory irritants. And we do a lot of public health work, sort of health surveillance, outbreak investigations. And that's a lot of the work we've been doing with sort of COVID as well, around a lot of these companies, how they can mitigate their risk. It's a very niche area of medicine and largely about what the evidence base is and how we use the evidence base to sort of reduce risk and get people back to work as soon as possible.
Yeah, I think you and I have had quite a few conversations about it, because myself as a professional rehabilitation counsellor, my work is specifically dealing with workers who've been injured at work, occupational health, safety components at work, and the medico-legal aspects as well. And we deal directly with doctors such as yourself to case manage a lot of workers who either are returning to the same workplace with adaptations or finding new workplaces if they happen to need to leave their place of work for whatever reason. I find it an incredibly interesting, diverse, but very niche area to work in. So I was really excited when you told me that you were going to go into it, because I kind of felt that I understood that area of medicine.
It's very rewarding work, isn't it, Pep?
Absolutely.
And you realize how important someone's work is to their personal sort of sense of self-worth, and work is so important. Medicine's changed a lot over the last 20 or 30 years, and we used to sort of keep people back home from work whenever they were injured or ill. You look at things like back pain, how the management has changed over the last couple of decades, and we realize that the sooner you get someone back to work, the quicker they're going to recover from their injury or illness.
Yeah, I suppose it's, for me, this whole COVID thing has been really interesting, and you'll understand this too, Brett, is, you know, one of our primary concerns as rehabilitation counsellors, you know, and we're professional, you know, we're clinical counsellors, many of us have trained in psychotherapy and things like that as well, but occupational bonding, that is bonding to work colleagues, bonding to work, maintaining that aspect of your identity, which is, you know, a huge aspect of our lives, our work and what we do. You know, for so many of us, including yourself and definitely me, work is about purpose. It's about why am I here and what am I contributing to the greater humanity? For me, it's that. For other people, it's a paycheck, but for me, it's a real vocation. And I think for a lot of people, it's the same thing. So occupational bonding is the really critical component of people who have maintained employment throughout COVID, maintaining the contact and maintaining their work identity.
It's very important, isn't it? And it's
absolutely.
A lot of people may feel they've lost it. Situations have changed. People are working from home. People are not seeing their colleagues anymore. People are probably feeling like they've lost a bit of that occupational bonding, which can also have detrimental sort of mental health effects like we just talked about earlier.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you've spoken about your pathway into medicine and particularly into occupational medicine now. Who were the people that you looked up to? Who've been the greatest influence on your professional career?
That's a hard question, Pep.
Everyone struggles with this one.
Yeah, it'd be hard to pinpoint one person. In terms of my entire career, my mother is probably my biggest influence. Mm-hmm. So my mother's been in tertiary education and Indigenous health for the last 20, 30 years. Cindy Shannon, so she's currently the Pro Vice Chancellor at Griffith University, Indigenous. Other than her, there's been too many to count. My current boss is a big influence on me, Dr. Sid O'Toole, and has provided me a lot of support in my journey through this specialty training. I think in my early career, Indigenous leaders like Adrian Carson was a big influence on me. He gave me my first job in Indigenous health. Jodie Curry, who's the current Brisbane Aches Chief Executive Officer, was a big influence on me. Sean Ewan has been a big influence on the last sort of 5 years of my career. There's just too many to count, Pep. Yeah, lots of support from lots of people in community.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. I know when I've spoken with some of the other people that I've interviewed, Exactly the same. You know, there's too many people that have influenced them to acknowledge every single person, but there are some people that have really stood out, particularly at certain transition points, that have, you know, made you think differently about things, or just giving you what you need to actually make some really critical life and career decisions.
I think relationships are very important to us. And I think, like you said, people come and go throughout our career sort of life and influence our career in different ways. And I think we've all had many sort of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people influence our careers in different ways. I've had many myself, both medical and non-medical, both in health sector and not health sector. And I think I'm extremely grateful. And I think what we learned from this is that we want to give back as well. And we want to sort of help sort of mold young sort of Indigenous people's careers and train when we can, teach when we can, and sort of give back as well.
Mm-hmm. How have your core values underpinned your work?
I think probably the biggest core value I have is around my ethics. And I think I was taught from a young age that never change your ethics for anyone, and never change your ethics sort of in any decision-making process, or never let anyone deter you from what you know is right. I think I've always tried to have a strong ethics, and I think starting on boards at a young age. So I was on my first board at the age of 23, and it's very daunting and a bit overwhelming to be on a board at such a young age with elders in the community and people sort of that you've looked up to your entire life. And even as a young person, you have to have a voice, and you have to have an opinion, and you have to sort of stick by your ethics and not let anyone change that for you, because I think that's the most important thing at the end of the day. I think I've been on boards for sort of over a decade now. And even if you don't agree with someone on a board, sort of it's a lot easier to sort of work with people that have sort of strong ethical values that are unwavering than people that you don't agree with. I actually like working with people I don't agree with, because it makes you sort of think back to your decisions and reflect. But working with people that have wavering ethics is just sort of something that I can't do.
Yeah, so inconsistency, which I think I'm with you. Trust is such a critical thing, particularly in decision-making, particularly in healthcare and in interpersonal relationships. And if someone's inconsistent in those aspects, obviously trust is the first thing that goes.
Definitely.
Yeah. Core values and personal motivations are really very similar. What motivates you to be the best that you can be every single day?
I think that's quite easy for me. I think I owe it to the people around me. Like I said to you before, I've had a lot of support from a lot of people, particularly over the last decade, to get where I am. A lot of people from community, a lot of family, a lot of friends. And I get up every day and do what I do because I owe it to the people around me. I feel like I've been put in a very privileged position, and I want to make the most of it for the people around me.
Yeah, absolutely. What does Indigenous leadership mean to you?
I've actually been asked this question before. So I got asked this question on a panel at an NHMRC conference a couple of years ago, and I tried to summarize it. It is a difficult question to answer, but I sort of summarized it into 4 points. The first one is that Indigenous leaders know what their community needs now, and they know what they're going to need in the future. And I said the second point was that they know how to develop strategies and be innovative to try and figure out how to meet those needs. The third thing I said was they're typically optimistic and positive about the future. And the fourth thing I said is that you see in Indigenous leaders, they have very good qualities, and they have all the human traits of leadership. And we talk just about ethics, but I talk about sort of honesty. I talk about courage, good values, good ethical values. And I think those are the four things that I talk about when I talk about Indigenous leadership.
Mm-hmm. What do non-Indigenous co-workers and colleagues, what do they have to learn from Indigenous leadership?
I think a lot. I think something that I sometimes see as different is that leadership sometimes in Western models can be measured by personal gains. And I don't think that's the case in Indigenous leadership at all. I think we measure it by other values. We measure it by the value of our relationships. With community, with family, with friends, I think there's some key differences in the values base. And I think that that's what could be learned from Indigenous leadership particularly.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you this question, but you have kind of alluded to it before. What do you like most about your profession?
Well, I like the challenge. I like seeing patients. I like that it's something different every day. I like that every patient has got a different condition that you have to manage. I like working with people. You get to work with all sorts of health professionals, not just doctors, but nurses, health workers, allied health professionals. I think I like the challenges it brings. I like the balance between seeing patients and doing research. I think it's just a perfect fit for me, to be honest. We kind of alluded earlier that it's kind of a job where you have to problem solve a lot. And I just have that mentality that I like solving problems. So I think that's what I like the most.
So what frustrates you the most about your profession?
I think it's changing, but I think obviously sort of the same frustrations people can have with doctors and people always allude to about doctors, about that stereotype, about not having a holistic, patient-focused sort of way of thinking. I think sometimes they just worry about the problem at hand and don't see the patient as a person. And I think that has changed over time. We look at all the research done now and you look at, let's take, for example, patients that have heart attacks. And we know now that the patients who have heart attacks who are depressed after their heart attack have much worse sort of outcomes through their rehabilitation than those who have strong mental health starting point. And so I think we're starting to get that point across that the patient sort of needs holistic care and sort of team-based care, not just treating the problem at hand. And I think sometimes that can be frustrating, just jumping to the problem at hand and not treating the patient as a human being.
Yep. Now, there's not many of you, but the numbers are growing. What do Indigenous doctors bring to your profession?
I think probably the first thing is what we just talked about is bringing a different lens. So they bring more of a holistic viewpoint. We try to see the person as a whole. We're very attuned to sort of the social and emotional well-being of the person, because that's sort of the clinical model that we've been brought up with. That's how our clinics are structured. More of a team-based care than a doctor-centric sort of Western model. I think that'll continue to grow. Sort of, I just talked about the trip to Alaska that I did in 2018, where it is true team-based care. Every patient is not just seen by the doctor, but they're seen by the doctor, the allied health, social and emotional well-being team, and the nurse at the same time. More like a emergency medicine model where everyone sees the patient at once and it's a true team-based arrangement. And I think Indigenous health is really leading the charge in that model in Australia to get away from being a doctor-centric model. And I think Indigenous doctors are very attuned to that and leading the way as well.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, there's not many. Sort of the specialty I'm in, occupational medicine, there's no Indigenous doctors and there's no qualified Indigenous physicians in that specialty.
Yep.
And so appropriate sort of work in this area for medico-legal responses to Indigenous people in Australia is grossly under-researched and under-acknowledged.
Yep. You've already outlined so much of the stuff that you've done over your career. Having known you for a while, I know that you're an incredible leader already. You do a lot of amazing stuff. How do you intend to use your leadership to impact, influence, or create change across your industry?
I just applied for a doctorate degree in the US that's supposed to start this year. And the point of that was to look at their models, particularly around occupational medicine and particularly around for vulnerable populations. So some of the work they've done is they've put Indigenous status or ethnicity onto compensation data, which we don't have in Australia. So in terms of Indigenous injuries and occupational medicine data, we have no idea about how big the problem is, where the problem is, so we can't address it adequately at all in Australia. A lot of my work in the future I want to do around injury prevention and treatment for Indigenous and vulnerable populations.
Yeah.
Learn from the lessons they've undertaken in the US, particularly in Illinois, about some of this work for vulnerable populations and Indigenous populations. This year, I was put on the expert advisory group for the National Injury Prevention Strategy for 2020 to 2030. And this taught me about some of the work we need to do for Indigenous injuries. Some of the data is just shocking in terms of our outcomes for the last 20 years, particularly around poisonings and things like that. So I think this is a niche area that I can hopefully contribute to and build international collaborations and do some successful work in to sort of reduce injury numbers in Australian Indigenous populations.
What does allyship mean to you?
It's an interesting word. I don't hear it much, but what first comes to mind is sort of long-term relationships, ongoing relationships, that people that want to build relationships with you and support you in what they believe is your cause. And we see a lot of this in Indigenous health and just health more broadly. I think particularly in Indigenous health over the last 20 years, as funding has significantly increased, a lot of support and goodwill has come across from certain people particularly in the health community. I think one of the issues is people just don't know where to start or what the starting point is. So I'll regularly get contacted by people looking for providing funding, looking to help where they can, and just not knowing who to engage and where to start and how they can help. And sometimes this can come across the wrong way, and sometimes it can come across the right way. Like I said, I think just because the funding has increased so much over the last 20 years and Indigenous health has really come to the forefront in some ways, there is a lot of goodwill there. It's just not targeted in the right direction sometimes.
Mm-hmm. So what are the knowledges, the skill sets and the behaviours that you believe make a good ally in Indigenous health spaces particularly?
Mm-hmm. I think firstly I'd say leadership without ego. I think when leadership comes with ego, you lose that goodwill and that good nature because people tend to then work on their own accord. So I think having a sense of humility that comes across is very important. It's very important when I choose people to work with, is that they have leadership without ego, they have humility in what they do, and they listen as much as they direct. One of my first mentors sort of taught me the importance of listening when I was a teenager, and being quiet at times can be just as powerful as being loud. And I think people tend to get excited, and goodwill and good nature can sort of overthrow into not listening and trying to do before you actually listen to what the problem is. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense, and if you'd agree with that, Pip.
Absolutely. You're very diplomatic as well. As an Indigenous person, as an Aboriginal man, what advice would you give non-Indigenous allies about being responsible, activated and effective?
I think the first thing I would say is work on your relationships. This year, I've had lots of sort of quick engagement from certain industries, certain organisations about wanting to make a quick difference. But this is not about making a quick difference. This is about building long-term relationships and building long-term engagement. This is not going to be a quick fix in terms of Indigenous health. I think that would be my first thing is, this is about everlasting relationships and how we're going to make those. The second one I would be is about, particularly in the tertiary education sector, we've talked a lot, even me and you, Pep, about recruitment versus retention. Yeah. And I think with goodwill, there becomes sort of quick recruitment drives and can turn into not enough thought being about the support structures that people need. And you're actually being detrimental to individuals' careers if you do not put adequate support structures into recruitment drives, and then your retention rates significantly decrease. Thinking about your decisions about how you're going to support Indigenous organisations, Indigenous students and Indigenous health needs a lot more rigour in terms of early strategising about how you can support organisations and people long term and set up adequate support structures throughout the process and ongoing feedback. That would be my first sort of advice.
Yeah, fantastic. I just love to hear people's opinions on allyship because it can be really controversial. And I'm not sure, I mean, you're not on Twitter, but having seen some of the stuff that occurs on there, it gets really toxic. And I don't think people understand how important allies are when they're responsible and when they're effective, and you know, when they walk alongside rather than try to walk in front or try to dictate from the sidelines. Yeah. What do you see as the major keys to empowering the health and well-being of Indigenous people, both locally and globally?
One of my mentors here in Brisbane has this saying, and his saying has always been, we want community control of Indigenous health. We don't want controlled community. And it sort of resonated with me that in terms of our funding, as funding's increased in Indigenous health, there's been a lot of red tape around it and red tape around what we do. And we really need community control in how we dictate how Indigenous health is managed, and not the other way around. In terms of controlling community through putting red tape and putting restrictions everywhere around how funding is used, it defeats the purpose of community control. I think you mentioned earlier in the interview that one of the most important things is trust. And if you're trying to control community, then you do not trust the Indigenous leaders of that community. If you allow for community control, it shows a sense of trust from government, from the broader community, that we will lead the sort of Indigenous health and Indigenous work in our community adequately. And I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. What is your unique vision for Indigenous people around the world?
I think the most important thing I have always felt is education, particularly tertiary education for Indigenous people. Education is going to lead to us influencing some of these decisions we've talked about and having greater control over our own communities. One of the most amazing things I would love to see is having an Indigenous university or Indigenous sort of tertiary service in one of the big universities in Australia that is sort of completely our own, completely linked to community clinics, to our Indigenous health services, and we have our own entire research hub. I think we have a long way to go in terms of tertiary education for Indigenous people in this country. And like we've said before, in terms of retention of Indigenous students for tertiary education, I think it's something that I would just love to see, particularly numbers for Indigenous health professionals, doctors, nurses, triple, quadruple during my lifetime, I think would be an amazing achievement.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, a number of other people I've interviewed, education's been the key. A similar vision to what you're having, something that is completely community oriented, that's totally not indigenized, not decolonized, but very much run, controlled and progressed by Indigenous people.
I think just seeing that, something like that set up that could foster collaboration around the country, is something much needed. We need to sort of collaborate instead of contest for funding.
Absolutely.
And I think that's really important.
And I think it's really critical for universities, if they are going to attract, retain and sustain Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students and really nurture them to be the incredible professionals that they end up being, doing very, very critical work in community across Australia, that they provide the absolute optimal support while they're studying on campus. That might be providing things that other students don't get access to, but it's about equity, not particularly just equality. It's about, if you have a particular vision to increase your Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander graduates because you want the university to look good, or it's really from a benevolent perspective, you have to be willing to provide the substantial levels of funding that the supports require. So, you know, social and emotional wellbeing supports, providing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander mental health professionals on campus for people to be able to talk with, providing beds in colleges, providing whatever is required and not as an afterthought, as an absolute priority.
Completely agree. I think a lot of the issues come from looking at it from a deficit model rather than the attitudes you just described.
Brett, thank you so much. I love talking with you. I always have a great conversation with you. You're great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Pepe.